The Stephansdom in Vienna, St. Stephen's Cathedral. It's the Catholic hub of a very Catholic country. So it's rather strange that for more than a century, its spire was crowned not by a gleaming cross, but a Muslim crescent. The mighty Ottoman host assembled by Suleiman the Magnificent in 1529 never reached this grand Habsburg square, but it was a close call. A century and a half later, the Ottomans staged a return match, and it was only with the aid of Polish troops that Vienna fought Istanbul to a draw. The crescent was removed from the spire and safely stored in one of the city's museums. But here in the Austrian capital, you don't have to walk very far to detect traces of what the Ottomans once described as Turkey in Europe. During the 18th century, when the Ottoman Empire was a feeble ghost of its former self, Turkey became fashionable in a rather patronizing way. The Empress Maria Theresia had her portrait painted in Turkish dress. Her nephew, Joseph II, commissioned an opera from Mozart set in an Ottoman seraglio, with a Turkish pasha playing the part of the good guy. Mozart just about sums up our attitude to Turkey in Europe. At one and the same time, it's distant and seductive, immediate and vaguely threatening. The Turks were finally defeated in 1683, more than three centuries ago, but they still haunt Vienna in more ways than one. They're present in the city's food and drink, its architecture and its design. But there's another Turkey in Europe, a Turkey of grudgingly tolerated migrant workers who come from a very different nation from the Empire of Suleiman. This programme is about the ambivalent relationship between near neighbours, something that puzzles Austrians and Turks alike. The retiring Turkish ambassador is Selim Yenil.
One thing that really struck me was a lack of knowledge between the two sides. Although we've been living together, either in this country or as neighbours throughout the millennia, we don't have a correct understanding of each other, and that's quite a pity. 1683 traumatized the population here, and you can see it all around the city. There's a lot of reminders of the Ottomans and the Turks. While as we, in 1923 and onwards, changed our perception towards the West to become a westernized country ourselves, and we thought that this was accepted by most of the Western countries, up until the Cold War, we thought that this was the case. And only when the Cold War ended did we find out that it was only us that changed and that Europe and Europeans did not change so much.
Cengiz Gunay is a political scientist working in Austria. His special interest is cultural and social transformation.
Today, people mainly remember, or school books teach mainly about the conflict. Actually, the Ottoman Empire opened itself in the beginning with the 17th, 18th century and was open to influence from Europe, more in cultural terms and also in political terms.
Entschuldigung.
Yeah,
guten Tag.
Ein großer Schwarzer bitte. Und ein Mineralwasser.
Turkey is with us here from dawn to dusk. Here in Julius Meinl's coffee house, I'm drinking a concoction which was first brewed after a Ukrainian officer was given some bags of beans left behind by retreating Ottoman armies. Even the croissants they're eating over there have dubious Turkish connections. There's a legend that they too are a double-edged tribute to the might of the Muslim crescent. What was the magnetic pull that drew the armies of Suleiman the Magnificent to the gates of Vienna? They'd conquered North Africa and Arabia, and their reach extended as far as Central Asia. So why did they need to plant the crescent banner on the foothills of the Alps? Perhaps it was because Suleiman's grandfather hadn't quite closed the deal 80 years before. Professor Andrew Wheatcroft has made a lifetime study of the aspirations of the Ottoman Turks.
A young man in his 20s,
And what he wanted to do was to make a mark on the world. And he also wanted, it seems to me, to right the wrong that he felt had been done to the Ottomans over the centuries, a tremendous sense of a dynastic inheritance as far as the Ottomans are concerned. And it was an easy push. Much better organized army, moved into Hungary, useless Hungarian army, founded on outdated Western models. The Ottomans defeated them at the Battle of Mohács, sat behind a whole row of wooden poles with their artillery and blasted them to pieces, basically.
But as it turned out, Vienna in the 16th century was no pushover. The Habsburgs were much better equipped than their Hungarian cousins, and the Sultan's army was repulsed. It took another century and a half before the Ottomans were in a position to have a second crack at penetrating Western Europe.
Why did they go to Vienna in the first place? For fantastical reasons. And the reason was that if they were able to take Vienna, Karim Mustafa, who was the Grand Vizier at the time, felt that it would be something that would make him unique in the history of the Ottoman Empire. He would have achieved what Suleiman failed to achieve. I mean, it was a kind of fantasy, and I think that the fantasy was it would fulfil a whole lot of statements of destiny, so to speak, that were kind of replete in the Ottoman histories.
Tradition places the Ottoman retreat in Kahlenberg, on the Vienna hills to the northwest of the city. I followed that tradition 10 years ago when I told the story for a Radio 3 documentary about Vienna. But I was probably wrong on two counts. Most historians now believe that the Turkish armies gathered on the Leopoldsburg, half a mile to the east, and the victorious army was led by King John Sobieski of Poland. So it wasn't an Austrian victory, and it happened somewhere else. Nevertheless, the notion that Austria saved Christendom from Muslim dominance still persists.
The fantasy, and I think it is a fantasy, that the Turks were going to kind of end up on sort of the English Channel was very unlikely. But the interesting thing is that people believed that this could happen. The event was so shocking that they could surround the city. I think that that dug very deep into the kind of Western psyche.
Still, the Austrian Habsburgs wanted to make sure that no one forgot their successes in coming to the defence of Christian Europe. When the Emperor Franz Josef ordered the largest arsenal in the Western world to be built here on the outskirts of the city, he also commissioned an imperial war museum and stuffed it with Ottoman plunder from the previous two centuries. Here's the great seal of Mustafa Pasha, captured by Prince Eugene of Savoy at the Battle of Lenva in 1697. In the next gallery is the huge tent of Damad al-Pasha, which Eugene plundered and adopted as a mobile hunting lodge. Most impressive of all is the mortar of Belgrade, which hit the Ottoman ammunition dump and wiped out 3,000 Turkish soldiers in the process. That was in 1717, and it marked the final failed attempt of the Ottoman Empire to command Central Europe. But Vienna was only an episode in a story which continued until the end of the First World War. Despite the slow decline of Ottoman Turkey, those eastern ghosts have continued to haunt the Austrians. Valeria Heuberger is a social and cultural historian who specialises in the minorities of Central and Eastern Europe. She sees relations between Turkey and her European neighbours as a complex mosaic.
Historical images or historical myth differ from Eastern and Western Austria. So for Eastern Austria, especially for Vienna, the danger for many centuries came definitely from the East, which was true. It was going back to medieval times, it was the Hungarians, then it was the Turkish armies, the Ottoman armies for many centuries. Also in popular culture, many songs, many poems, many legends deal with these belligerent centuries, with this warfare which lasted for centuries between the Habsburg Empire and between the Ottoman Empire.
Austria today has the second largest Turkish population in Europe. In Vienna, at the end of Ramadan, tents are erected on the edge of the Ringstrasse, and tourists are offered oriental sweets and pastries, accompanied by the tinkle of a Turkish lute. On the surface, the city authorities are generous hosts to their Turkish minorities, but superficial impressions can sometimes be misleading.
Vienna's 10th district is Austria's little Istanbul, or at least it should be. But most of the Ottoman residue in the city is restricted to a few fragments scattered around the Habsburg monuments of the inner town. Tonight, we're in Atip, the Turkish cultural and faith centre, located in a nondescript 60s block off the main thoroughfare. Low ceilings, blank walls, and the only colour coming from the vivid traditional shawls and skirts of the women, segregated at the far end of the room from their business-suited middle-aged menfolk. Here in the Turkish Bezirk, the only Ottoman echoes are in the background chatter and the baklava and the salads on the table. Tonight is a bayram, a festival to mark the end of Ramadan, given a little extra spice by blending with a farewell party for the departing Turkish ambassador. For Vienna's Turkish guest workers, it's a celebration tinged with anxiety, as the ambassador knows only too well.
The guest workers have come here, but I think that to many Austrians they have overstayed their welcome. They were supposed to go back, but they did not. They decided to stay here for economic reasons, for well-being. And some have integrated well, but not all. And those who have not integrated well look different than the Austrians. And of course, this caused some resentment. And let me be candid here. I think that religion and culture does play a certain role here. I mean, previous minorities were of the same, at least, if not Catholic, but at least they were all Christian. And now we're talking about a Muslim minority, which is different. 9/11 has not helped. The things that we see in the Middle East or Afghanistan have not helped. This all gives Islam or the Muslims a bad name.
If conflicts come into being, I would say it's not only because a woman is wearing a headscarf or a man would wear a traditional Arab garment. The point is that very often different lifestyles cause problems. Sometimes if you stroll through these marketplaces, you feel like you're in Istanbul or in Sarajevo or somewhere else in a more oriental part or more Balkan part of Europe. But I would say that's more or less the same process which is going on Europe-wide. So Austria is no exception.
It's only 9 subway stops from the Stephansdom to Brunnengasse, but I might as well have bought a ticket to Ankara. The Brunnenmarkt sits on the outskirts of the Gürtel, Vienna's outer ring road. The market is a little more relaxed and less manic this afternoon than the 10th district was yesterday. Ramadan is ended. The mad dash to eat and drink once the sun has set is now over. There's more time to take in Zumrut, the jewellers, the bridal shops, the carpet dealers, the aubergines and hot peppers on the food stalls, the salty white cheeses, olives, and stalls that sell nothing but coffee. Over there is Burka Textil and Istanbul Textil. The Harp restaurant is still offering iftar itap, the special 6:30 buffet to break the fast. And the sound of the Turkish language is spiced with the occasional burst of Kurdish.
In Brunnengasse, you could be forgiven for thinking that Austria is the model of multiculturalism. But we shouldn't forget that the anti-immigrant Freedom Party has twice held the balance of power in parliament. The sociologist Cengiz Günay has a more nuanced view of Austrian tolerance.
I think Austria is a country which is not used to integrate different cultures in a way. Because we have a long history of integration. Look at all the Czechs and the Slovaks and the Hungarians and so on and so forth. We integrated during the era of the Habsburg Empire. But of course, that was assimilation, actually. So integration is very often mixed up with the assimilation, and people expect migrants to become Austrians, like any other Austrian, to change probably their names into Hans and Grete or something. And it is less accepted that they are behaving in a different way.
These sentiments are shared by a small but vocal group of Austrian politicians in local and national government. Omar Al-Rawi was born in Baghdad, but as a city councillor, he represents all Vienna's Muslim minorities.
Most of them mixed up integration with assimilation. And this comes back also to its historian development. We had a lot of Hungarians, Czech, Bohemians, the so-called Ostblock countries. And all these people went the way of assimilating themselves. So you just rarely find only their names called Pavkovic and Svoboda and Veseli and Klestil, but they lost their language, they lost their former culture, they lost even the ability of their cooking and kitchen. And that's why the Viennese and the Austrians, only when they see someone who lost everything except his name, he is a well-integrated person. That is one of the things which sometimes with the Islam, because it's another faith, it's another religion, there are some habits and customs which will never change. Of course, one of the huge problems is this wearing the headscarf, which causes for a lot of the ladies extremely discrimination when they want to get a job. And we have to admit that there is a new phenomenon in Europe and also in Austria, it's called Islamophobia. And this phenomenon would be a challenge for both of the society to deal with in the next years.
Istanbul-born Alev Korun sits in the National Parliament. She's an MP for the Greens, but her brief also includes minority issues. She, too, is conscious of the legacy of Austria's past relations with her Turkish neighbours.
In the public consciousness in Austria, there is still very much living the fact that the so-called Turks, or we call them actually Ottomans in Turkey, that Ottomans have been trying to conquer Austria or Vienna. In public schools, pupils hear that the Turks were trying to conquer Austria. And this has, of course, quite heavy consequences on pupils with a Turkish background living in Austria, you know, to hear that you, in quote marks, tried to conquer our country, which is not good, I think, because many of these pupils are Austrian citizens. They were born in Austria, they grow up in Austria, and they will be the managers and the teachers and the politicians of our country from tomorrow.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
In the 10th district, the sound of evening prayers and the ubiquitous headscarves and hijabs are constant reminders of the otherness of Vienna's Muslim minorities. But otherness in Vienna is not a new phenomenon.
The last census from 1910 indicated that Franz Joseph, the old emperor, he ruled over approximately 52 million people. And we had various nations, we had Slavic people, we had, of course, Hungarians, Italians, Ukrainians, Czechs, Slovaks, Romanians, and many other. And among these many groups, there was also one group of Muslims living in Bosnia-Herzegovina. So that Viennese, that Austrians, got acquainted with Islam goes back already to the time of the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
Ah, yes, Bosnia. The only European country where Muslims make up more than 80% of the population. A nation synonymous in the media not with integration, but with disintegration. I've visited the country three times since the War of the 90s, and I've grown to love Sarajevo, that most Ottoman city west of Turkey. If Austria is deeply conflicted about its Turkish legacy, perhaps Bosnia can give us a different image of Turkey in Europe. The former Oxford professor of modern history, Norman Stone, is now based in Ankara and Istanbul. For him, Bosnia isn't a symbol of conflict, but a testament to the successful collaboration of two cultures.
They got on very well in Bosnia, in days of Suleiman, 17th century, it's a very go-ahead place, and it was on a major trade route running to Dubrovnik. Sarajevo was an important place, and it works in a way that Western European cities at the time would not have worked, you know, with proper running water and attempts to control epidemics. Also, the other thing that's so striking about Bosnia is that the native Bosnians and the Ottomans got along perfectly well. I mean, if you think of the numbers of people who were very prominent in the Ottoman court, an awful lot of them were Bosnian, including some of the very great, memorable Grand Viziers, all came from that part of the world.
So how did this epitome of tolerance come to symbolise racial disharmony? Let's hear what some native Bosnians have to say. We'll begin with the leader of Bosnia's Muslims, the Grand Mufti Imam Ceric.
The nature of Bosnia has been for more than 1,000 years of the multicultural, multi-ethnical, multinational society. This is not something new, because Bosnia-Herzegovina is a treasure of this multicultural and multinational environment, which we cannot destroy. I am shocked that we don't have partners in Europe to understand that. I am shocked that Europe is not helping us to keep this multicultural and multinational state.
How about a politician? Ejup Ganic was president of Bosnia-Herzegovina in the late 1990s.
We are an original country which has a diversity of everything. And those countries which are multidimensional in that respect are not common in Europe to some extent. So that's why there are some troubles, jealousy or whatever you call it for, that exist here. But we are small and beautiful, original, and we continue to survive all the infections that they are trying to impose on us from the side.
Mirsad Pulavatra found inspiration in Bosnia's multicultural past when he launched the Sarajevo Film Festival, even as the snipers fired on the city from the surrounding hills.
Let's start with the region, considering the region step by step as some kind of the crossing road or as a central point of two big empires. Because Sarajevo spent 500 years under the Ottoman Empire and 50, but very successful and very nice, 50 years of Austrian-Hungarian Empire. And we found that those two empires are really meeting each other in Sarajevo. In one street, in just 50 meters, you can see very strong traces of Ottoman Empire, and just next 5 meters you can see such beautiful Austrian-Hungarian buildings or some other traces.
When I first came to Sarajevo 12 years ago, I did what every passing hack did. I grabbed an overpriced taxi from the airport, stayed at that dreary legend, the Holiday Inn on Sniper's Alley, and entered the city from the west. Walking down Marshal Tito Street, it was a shock when the paving stones suddenly became cobbles and a Habsburg city transformed into a Turkish market. Coming this time from the Ottoman East is a quite different experience. 4 minarets guard the 4 corners of the bazaar. Greeting visitors at the entrance to the old town is Istanbul Turksi Doner Kebab. Every second shop is Turka or Divan. Coppersmiths, hammer, and the music is all traditional Sevda, the melancholy love songs which were born in the years when Sarajevo was governed from Istanbul by the sublime Porte. The whole district is called Bajasha, the bazaar district, and that's what it does, buying and selling. It always did. From the moment that the Sultan Bayezid II established Ottoman rule here at the turn of the 16th century. Sarajevo is, was, and hopefully always will be, the most Ottoman cosmopolis west of the Bosphorus. It was not only a power centre for the empire, even more important, it was the primary trading post between east and west.
You'd find goods from Persia, the Levant, and even as far distant as Central Asia. Sitting here in the cobbled wooden courtyard of the Moricha Han, which was a pit stop for spice and silk merchants for 300 years, you can sip better Turkish coffee than you'll get in Izmir and buy a kelim at knockdown price. If any square mile in our multicultural continent defines Turkey in Europe, it's here in eastern Sarajevo. This is the Bosniak Center, a gleaming modern construction just down the road from the market at the junction of Christian and Muslim Sarajevo. It conceals two surprises. The first is that in 1998, it was an impossible dream. Impossible because Bosniaks were either cowering in their houses or swelling the Bosnian diaspora in Western Europe and the USA. Second surprise, behind the shiny glass foyer, behind the dazzling marble, is a 500-year-old Turkish bath. It was transformed courtesy of a member of that very Bosnian diaspora, a banker. He fled not the Serbs, but Marshal Tito and the communists. This centre only became possible 6 years ago, after the Dayton Accords.
We are entering now the hammam proper. We are in a small room that was used most probably for massage or deep cleansing or shaving. The dresses and what we have around here as a display, because obviously we use all this space for display of different things, these are urban dresses of Bosnia by the end of 19th century. These particular ones come from the family of the founder of our institute, Mr. Zulfikar Pašić, and they belonged to aristocratic and rich family, and these examples are really very well preserved. In Bosnia, if we speak of Bosnia, traditional dress was worn well after First World War. And even today, there are people who wear full traditional clothes today. Bosnia was an important province and different from the rest of the empire, but it was also quite remote. And I would explain that this might be the reason why we sort of held on to it. And especially after the fall of the Ottoman Empire, you had a feeling here of a way of nostalgia for Ottoman leaving Bosnia, because majority of population were Muslims and they felt Ottomans not as invaders, most of them, but they felt attached and being part of one large empire.
Once that empire ended, its constituent parts began to curdle. The bells from the cathedral at one end of the street started to clash with the prayers in the mosque 200 metres to the east. In the middle, left without a name or a state, were the Bosnian Muslims, known as Bosniaks. Their leader, the Grand Mufti, owes his office to an agreement made in the final years of the Habsburg Empire. When the Austro-Hungarians took responsibility for Bosnia in the 1870s, they wanted to make sure that the Muslim community had an identity and a leader. A century later, the office of Grand Mufti is about all that's left from those 60 years of Austro-Ottoman tolerance.
The Bosniaks at the moment, at the Balkan, are the most neglected nation and the most neglected people. And, which is the paradox, we are suffering because of this negligence. And if we try to belong to Turkey, they charge us, why you want to revive the Ottoman Empire? If we want to be part of the European Union, they say you are not qualified because you are not wanted here because there are terrorists and criminals among you. So then our question is, we belong to whom? Who is our mother and father? Where is the center or anybody that will claim that these people belong to me?
Bosnia contains two of Europe's most notorious bridges. 3 hours to the west is the serene and graceful Ottoman bridge over the Neretva in Mostar, which we saw being pulverized by the Croats on live TV during the war. Here in Sarajevo,
is the even more fateful Prinsipmost, where the heir to the Habsburg throne was clumsily assassinated in 1914 and was the first of millions of victims in the Great War which followed. But if you ignore the 20th century for a moment and look upwards, you can see why Sarajevo was the most significant crossroads for Turkey in Europe. The little river below us is dwarfed by an arc of precipitous hills. We can all remember the rockets and missiles fired from their crest by the Serb snipers 15 years ago. But 5 centuries ago, the geography here made this town a crucial link in the trading routes from the Christian north to the Muslim south, and from the Empire of the Ottomans to the Holy Roman one to the west. The Turks established many centres of government in their empire, but none was more prosperous than this little trading post sheltered in the crack across the South Slav lands. That's why you can hear Orthodox bells competing with Catholic chimes and the call to prayer. Across the river, there's an Ashkenazi synagogue, and 4 streets behind me, there's a Sephardic one. We might think that Sarajevo symbolizes conflict, but it's actually one of the most multicultural, multi-confessional places on the continent.
People here are quite tolerant, and you can imagine that during the recent war, Sarajevo was under siege for almost 4 years, and they were not able to destroy the bonds that exist among different ethnic communities. All the Orthodox churches survived that siege. All Catholic church survived that siege. Synagogue survived that siege. We somehow had the guards around to prevent intruders to come to destroy them. Sarajevo was the best marriage between East and the West, and it kept the glory of both. That's what made Sarajevo to be unique, and it still is.
That was Eyüp Ganić, post-war Bosnia's former president. A subjective take on Bosnian tolerance, as you might expect. But a more objective judge, the historian Andrew Wheatcroft, sees it as part of the national DNA.
The curious thing about Bosnia is, of course, everyone's a Slav. There are very few non-Slavs, so to speak. So there are Islamized Slavs, there are Christian Slavs, but they share the same family connections. And that went on for so long. I mean, if you look, I was looking recently at some postcards and some photographs of Bosnia in the 1920s and 30s, and they look as though they're 200 or 300 years old. Nothing very much changes. That somehow there's a sediment which is settled on the hills and the valleys and so on that's impossible to shift.
It's in the cultural legacy that we can hear the most potent Turkish traces in the Balkans. During the war, many Bosnian musicians sought refuge in Western Europe. Since then, the melancholy strains of Sevda music have come to characterize the national temperament. Like Bosnia itself, it weaves Turkish and Slav threads into a single fabric. Exotic Asian modes are decorated with Central European instruments like the accordion. One singer, who refused to leave Sarajevo despite the violence of the siege, is Amira Medunjanin.
Our country has become, by force, a new country. It was rather tough period, you know, and people were turning back to themselves. People were trying to find their identity again, and the best way to achieve that was through cultural heritage. Traditional music for each of those ex-republics and now the countries is affected big time by the Ottoman influence. So all those stories that actually were transferred into these Sevda songs matched absolutely perfectly with the melodies brought from Turkey, for instance.
Not just the melodies and more than just the pain. When I was here 10 years ago, one writer insisted that she spoke Bosnian and not Serbo-Croat. Bosnia was still on life support, and the language was a drip feed of collective memory. Throughout former Yugoslavia, you'll hear Turkish words absorbed unconsciously into everyday speech. The Croat historian Ivo Banic.
Of course, many of these words are of Ottoman Turkish origin, but there are as many that were brought to these parts by the Ottoman Turks that are of Arabic or Persian origin. Some of them have supplanted Slavic terms. For example, in many of the South Slavic languages, the common Slavic word for color, which is cvet, does not exist. We use the term boya, which in Turkish does not mean color, it means paint. But all the same, there is no other word for color in Croatian, in Serbian, in Bosnian.
For ordinary Bosnians, when the war ended, it wasn't the Dayton settlement that brought the nation back to life. It was the rediscovery of cultural roots in the film festival and the jazz festival, and most of all, in the amateur and semi-professional groups which sprang up in the bloodstained streets. Tijana Vignjević directs a choir founded in the cellars of Sarajevo during the siege.
Music can bring people together. And it was so funny because every time till now, when someone would ask me about mixed choir, they would say, what do you mean mixed? Is it Serbs, Croats and Muslims? And I said, no, it's men and women. So of course, in a choir, there are Serbs, Croats, Muslims, Jews and everybody. So for people, it's also very nice to see that it is possible to live together.
It's a paradox. Sarajevo is the most Ottoman city in Europe. It's also the city most torn apart by ethnic and cultural conflict. Yet until the First World War, it was a blueprint for how four religions and three ethnic groups could live fruitfully together. Could it be that 450 years of Ottoman-Turkish influence left a legacy not of conquest, but of coexistence? On January the 1st, 2010, Istanbul became the cultural capital of Europe. But at least half the nations in the European Union are still resistant to admitting Turkey into the fold. What are they frightened of? Headscarves? A high birth rate? Or is it simply that Turkey in Europe makes us question our long-held assumptions about who we are and where we came from? For the social historian Cengiz Gunay, a complex web of cultural and ethnic divergence has been oversimplified into a conflict between different religious systems.
What we have since September 11, of course, is this culturalization of religion and the religionization of culture, of course, vice versa, and these discussions going on about the clash of civilization. So, of course, this has also affected Austrian society, and all of a sudden, the word foreigner was substituted or replaced by the word Muslim, for instance. Now it's a foreigner is a Muslim. So the other is very clearly specified and identified.
The former Turkish ambassador Selim Yenil and the local councillor Omar Al-Rawi looked to the European Union for resolution.
We are a secular country and we happen to be Muslims. We are not an Islamic country. That's the basic difference with all the other countries who have a Muslim population. Just as Austria happens to be Christian, we happen to be Muslim. Nothing more than that. Nevertheless, of course, it has become an issue these days. But I believe that as long as the EU keeps on saying that this is not a Christian club, then it has to prove it. And what better way to prove it than to have Turkey inside?
Europe promised Turkey since the 50s that they have the chance. And I think we should stand to our word. When we give the promise that they could be a member, they're a member in the European Football Association, they're a member of the European Council, they even won the European Song Contest.
If the Eurovision Song Contest can open the doors of the EU, then perhaps Amira is a better ambassador for Turkey in Europe than an army of politicians. Bosnia's creative community certainly seems to have come to terms with history more completely than some of her clergy and politicians. Imam Ceric.
You are part of our problem and you are part of our solution. So get here and work with us together, and so that we come get on our feet and we are part of the European society, whether you like it or not. So come here, let us work together, and let us see that we deserve respect and we deserve our place in the families of Europe.
The deconstruction of Yugoslavia revealed how far we'd come from the 400 years of tolerance which the Ottoman occupation of the Balkans represented for so many people. Ironic, really, that just when Bosnia was being torn apart, Vienna was welcoming all the Hungarians, Czechs and Poles newly liberated on the other side of the Iron Curtain. Valeria Heuberger witnessed a new multiculturalism in her native country.
Vienna has this very long record of being like a bridge or a crossroad between cultures, between peoples and between religions. And I can tell from my personal experience that Vienna really became a colorful city in the real sense of the word.
But embracing the otherness of Turkey in Europe is an even greater challenge. It would be reassuring if the values which inform Mirshad Puravatra's film festival in Sarajevo might make us forget our fear of our neighbours to the east and embrace everything they have to offer.
Unfortunately, the meaning Balkan has more negative than positive side. On the other side, Balkan word has some kind of the folklore, still undiscovered, meaning something what belongs more to adventure, I would say, to the people who are a little bit strange, but on the other side could be also interesting people. Because no doubt that we bring some kind of the energy which is missing in Europe today.
Turkey in Europe was written and presented by Dennis Marks and was a Brooke Lapping production for BBC Radio 3. It was first broadcast last February.